Kelly Kasar-Jane Show Talk Radio for Fine Minds airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieKasarJane.com. And thank you so much for being here. I am Hallie Kasar-Jane. Today on the Hallie Kasar-Jane Show, it's hooray for Hollywood and hooray for the Oscars, as the Hallie Kasar-Jane Show takes a look at the 87th Academy Awards. Joining me at my table is the esteemed film critic for the Los Angeles Times, Betsy Sharkey, and director, writer, producer, Charles Matthau. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to the Hallie Kasar-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasar-Jane Show is always available online at HallieKasarJane.com and a host of venues, including Blog Talk Radio. And be sure to visit us at iHeartRadio. Today, the Hallie Kasar-Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasar-Jane Show. Hello, I'm Hallie Kasar-Jane, host of The Hallie Kasar-Jane Show. Join me Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, when I talk with the great artists, writers, musicians, politicians, and celebrities of our day. The Hallie Kasar-Jane Show is talk radio for fine minds. Tune in live or listen to the podcast at HallieKasarJane.com. Los Angeles Times film critic Betsy Sharkey is an award-winning entertainment journalist and best-selling author. She began her career as a feature writer for the Dallas Morning News and has since written for the New York Times, TV Guide, and Esquire, among others. She joined the Los Angeles Times as an entertainment editor before becoming a film critic. She collaborated with Oscar-winning actress Faye Dunaway on her memoir, Looking for Gatsby, and wrote Marlee Matlin's memoir, I'll Scream Later. In addition to her critical essays and reviews of about 200 films a year for The Times, Sharkey's weekly movie reviews appear in newspapers nationally and internationally. She is a member of the Los Angeles Film Critics Association, the Society for Professional Journalists, and Cinema for Peace's International Jury. She holds a degree in journalism and a master's in communications theory from Texas Christian University. Let's talk.
So, Betsy, let's jump right into the thick of it. What's wrong with films today, or what's right with films today? I mean, you hear so much talk about everybody pining for the good old days. Maybe that's true, maybe it's not. What are your thoughts?
Well, that's a small question. I actually feel like it's been a great year. I mean, to me, what we have seen is some of what I felt had been missing in the past. If you look at Grand Budapest Hotel, I mean, that's an incredible artistic vision by a filmmaker who does not fit within any kind of Hollywood model. Richard Linklater in Boyhood, taking 12 years to put together something. I'm amazed that he ever got the funding and to come up with something so intimate and so true and so personal. So I actually look at this year's awards and I'm incredibly encouraged. I feel like there is hope for the future, if nothing else, because it feels like the auteurs, those filmmakers with a vision and a voice, really, really were heard this year.
You know, I'm loving this. You speak as well as you write, and you write beautifully. We forget that film critics are great writers, and I really want everybody to go to read Betsy's critiques, because you know how to write, lady. You're powerful as well. I'm sure you get that. But with that all in mind, how do you watch a film? And when you sit down, what are you doing? Are you going crazy? Are you saying to yourself, gosh, I hope I love this picture. I hope I don't hate it, or I hope it's going to be everything it's been. What are your thoughts when you sit down?
Well, I actually try to go in and have it just be, make myself as much as possible a blank canvas. If I have loved or hated the filmmaker's work, before, if I have loved or hated the actor's work before, all of that I want to set aside, because I'm no good to you or anyone else if I come in with all kinds of baggage. I need to leave myself open to the experience, so I try to do that. And then I'm like I actually had someone ask me if they could go to see a movie with me and then talk afterwards. I'm like the worst person to see a movie with, because I actually don't want to talk afterwards. I like to let everything settle in. I like to think about it, process it, absorb it. And I don't like to discuss it with anyone else, including my editors, until I've written. Because sort of for better or for worse, I want that clarity of thought, and I want whatever that thought is, whether it is absurd or idiotic or intelligent, to be mine. So that's kind of how I go at it. However, I will say, if it's based on a book, I will read the book ahead of time. If it's based on a stage play, I will try to see it or read the play.
Wow.
And so I do a lot of prep work, and if I haven't seen the director's work in a while, I will, I just keep Netflix in business, making sure that I have all the context I feel like I need going in, set it aside, go see the film, and then bring it all back together before I write.
That's interesting. What gets you most crazy about the film industry today? Anything?
What drives me the most crazy?
Yeah.
You know, I always want to be in that room where everyone was sitting there trying to convince each other that it really is, it's a good movie. You know, if we just tighten it here and there, it'll be fabulous. Or if we just lay another soundtrack. I mean, I just see so much money spent on so many films that are so marginal, mediocre. It's so easy to come by. And you just wonder why. Why not take a risk on something else? Why not do that? I see a lot of films every year, and the number that are good are, it's so small in relation to the number that I see. So, speaking, that drives me crazy.
Thank you. I'm glad that drives you crazy, because I think that's a good, if anything is gonna, that's a good thing, because there should be a level of excellence. And talking about that in this vein, 87th Oscar Awards, the Academy Awards have been nominated fabulous pictures, but only a few. They could have nominated 10 and they didn't. Is it because there weren't 10 really great films to be nominated?
No, and some of this I can't discuss because I will be writing about that next week. I think that there were actually some that were stolen, and I hopefully I've got some interesting options. Okay, I'll talk about one. Guardians of the Galaxy, that kind of film never makes it in, and yet it was really well done, very, very funny, clever in almost all the kind of criteria that we use to judge a film. The performances were great. The special effects were really good. People loved it. You know, why do we never consider a film like that? On the other hand, I would say A Most Violent Year.
Mm.
Beautiful film. Really smart, really intelligent, not one word wasted. Incredible performances by Oscar Isaacs and Jessica Chastain. And yet, did it come too late? The Academy just didn't take time to take a look at it and consider it. Those would be at least two of the films that I would say should have been in there, and I don't know why they weren't. And if I could hold someone's feet to the fire, I would, and I will.
There is a certain film that you can watch and know that's going to be the one that's going to be nominated. You know, there's an Academy Award look to a film, I think. Do you?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that there is that kind of thing, and it often plays into the choices. I certainly think last year, 12 Years a Slave, man, that just looked, it was socially important, beautifully shot, well acted. It spoke to something larger than life itself as we know it. I mean, it felt important. It felt significant. So it seemed like I would have been shocked if it had not made it in. We have a much more eclectic group this year. We don't have as many of that kind of film, but I certainly think The Imitation Game and The Theory of Everything, those are two films. They felt significant. They were talking about significant things in the both on a personal level and a humanistic level, and then also on a much bigger level. In both cases, these are about men who had a huge impact on the world as we know it. So they seem like, of all the lineup, they seem like the ones that seem like naturals. Selma, in its own way, kind of hits on an interesting line, because there are ways in which it feels significant and important, but the way that the director chose to tell the story, which I thought actually was quite brilliant, by taking just this one slice in time and looking at both the man, Martin Luther King Jr., and the moment, and using that to tell the story. So it became more than just his story. It became a story about that moment in time in our culture and how things change. So that's why I think it hasn't done quite as well when you look across the awards in terms of acting and screenplay and so forth and so on. But
the social significance, Hollywood is so keyed into that in its filmmaking. One of your reviews that you wrote, and I read all your reviews, I was like kind of mad.
I'm so sorry.
No, are you kidding?
My condolences.
No. There was a reason I asked you to be on the show. You are one of my favorite critics. I love the way you write. I love the way that you perceive things. Not everybody does perceive the way that you do. And you see things on a very multi-level point of view, where others, you know, take it from the acting view or from the director view, but you see it all, and you see it from the social significance, and you wrote about that too, right, in terms of some of the films this year.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I feel like is when you watch a film, anyone, not just a critic, but just anyone, you are affected by what is going on in your life and in the world at that time. And I had taken a look back at Gone with the Wind, which is celebrating its 75th anniversary this year. And seeing it again now, there are so many things about it. And I did not see it 75 years ago.
Just, you're not that old.
to clear that up. But but seeing it again now versus seeing it when I did on late night movies on television when I was a kid, it had so many things about it I found so difficult to watch now. And then in watching Selma, I felt like it was impossible to see that film and some of the shots of the protests and how protesters were treated and not hear the echoes today of Ferguson and, some of the other kind of racial conflicts that we still have in our country. And I'm not equating voting rights to somebody being picked up by the cops for doing something or not doing something wrong, but nevertheless, that sort of arrest versus voting rights and a civil rights action. But on the other hand, it's impossible to see some of these films and just not in some way look at it within the context of the culture and experience and think about that. Or at least I hope people think about that sort of thing.
Yeah, and that gets into something else, which is what you present to people is a very personal point of view. And you're self-assured in that. You understand filmmaking. That's your art. That's what you've grown up around in terms of your career. And so people, I would assume you want people to take what you put out there, right, which is all of these things that your personal point of view about, the social aspects of a film or your knowledge or your eye for costume or for lighting or for words and suggest, right? I mean, I think, tell me about that role of critic from your vantage point.
One of the things that people think is that we are like judges and we are handing down a ruling, and I don't see my role like that at all. I mean, I feel like I'm just part of the conversation. Hopefully I add something intelligent or cause people to think about something in a certain way, but I only, that's all I want to be, is part of the conversation, because it's just sort of like what I think alone doesn't matter. I'm just the tree falling in the forest.
Right.
It is only what happens when I throw my opinion out there, and then I hear back from people, and that kind of exchange and interchange, or, you know, whether you love what I write or you hate what I write, if it made you think, then I feel like I've succeeded.
So I have to ask you, just between you and me, okay? Nobody's listening.
Yeah.
All right. Well, you ever get pressure from the filmmakers?
No. Well, actually, yes, but I don't pay any attention to it. I mean, basically what I have occasionally happen is someone who reacts to what I have written, but ahead of time, no, because I have, and I imagine all critics do in some way, but I have a wall that I put up, and even the publicists, they know better now, but anyone who calls to ask me my reaction of a film, I will not tell them anything until I write, and that's just my personal policy. If for no other reason, because I am thinking all the way through that process, I don't stop thinking, and my editors will tell you that I don't even stop thinking after I've filed. I'm forever jumping back on to make some revisions or to try to find some sort of better nuanced way to express something. But I have had some very angry filmmakers who have sent me emails that I have saved, by the way.
Really? So, there's a book. You got to write a book.
You know, honestly, it's like what I said about the rest of people who read. I want some reaction. If I get no reaction, then I feel like I've done nothing. So, and I also, you know, even though I have made people angry, I hope that the thing that they get, even if I don't like a film, that I try not to be mean-spirited about it. I mean, I do like to have fun with some films because some films are just so bad that you got to have a little fun with them. But I try not to be mean. I mean, I do try to keep in mind that these are real people out there, and I honestly don't think even the worst films in the world, people don't set out to make a bad movie. They would all like to make great movies. It's just that not many of them do.
You've got to be made of steel. God bless you. I couldn't handle it. And you're a girl from, you're a kid from Texas, right? I mean, aren't you from Texas originally?
Or, I am from Texas.
Right.
Yes.
So you're just like a quote unquote a small town girl who comes to the big city, makes good. You got to have that part of you that's going, oh, please don't hate me. Please don't hate me. You know, it's like, I couldn't do what you did. That's all I have to say. I absolutely could not. Can we go through some of the nominees? Let me and hear what you have to say. All right, great. I'm very curious as to where you are on it. I'm going to give you the list of the best supporting actress, Patricia Arquette in Boyhood, Laura Dern in Wild, Keira Knightley in The Imitation Game, Emma Stone in Birdman, Meryl Streep in To the Woods. And let's talk Meryl Streep for one quick second. Can this girl do
okay.
no wrong? Can she do no wrong? I mean, she's like a train coming and she's got all the energy. Everybody always, come on, she's not that perfect. I mean, she's had some flawed performances. Help me here. I don't get her all the time.
Well, you know, I think part of it is she is indeed always performing at the top of her craft. I certainly think that, and I'm blanking on the film, the Iron Lady.
Margaret Thatcher.
To me, that was not her best performance. It was not the best movie. The Academy seems to love her. I don't think Into the Woods, because she did a fine job with it, but I think that there are enough other really terrific actors in the game, or actresses in that particular category, that she won't. But I think part of it is that people really like her not only as an actress, but as a person. We have a lot of people that are in the industry and that have been successful that do not seem as nice as Meryl Streep. And I think the actors represent a huge voting block in the Academy. And she is one of the most generous actresses out there. She makes sure that whatever she puts on screen, that whoever she is playing opposite, she makes room for them. It's not like someone who has diva moments
right on
screen.
She's giving.
You just sense that sharing and that respect that she has for her colleagues, and I think that's part of it.
So in that category, who do you think is going to get it? Who do you want?
Patricia Arquette.
And is that a family thing? Because, you know, it's the same. You know, Diane Ladd and I are very dear friends, and I know she took an ad in Hollywood Reporter for Laura. And Arquette is a family, an old Hollywood family. Does that play into it?
To some extent, it does. But I think it's because there are two things. I thought Laura Dern was very good in Wild, but I think that it's one of those things where the film that is surrounding you sometimes plays into it. And Boyhood was extraordinary. It was
yes.
an extraordinary portrait, not just of a boy, but of our culture, and in Patricia Arquette's case, of a single mother. And I do think that sometimes it's a situation where people, and I think it's to some extent the same case with J.K. Simmons. You have actors who are, even if they have quote-unquote family connections, they have been in the trenches for a very long time. They have worked very hard, and they finally get a role that allows them to show everything that they're made of, everything that they have. They can break it down to the bone. They leave it completely out there on screen. Nothing is left. Nothing is hidden. And that is the case with both of those two people, and that's why I think they'll get it.
Best Supporting Actor, Robert Duvall in The Judge, in Boyhood, Edward Norton in Birdman, Mark Ruffalo in Foxcatcher, J.K. Simmons in Whiplash. We're just talking about them. A lot of these actors have been in a whole lot of films, and you almost sometimes feel that they get nominated not just for the film they're nominated, but for the body of their work. Agreed?
Well, certainly with Robert Duvall. With Ed Norton, I mean, that category is just killing me because I loved J.K. Simmons. I loved Whiplash. I've been a big fan of that film. But Edward Norton was
amazing, brilliant
in Birdman. He was fantastic. I loved him. So it's killing me. That one is killing me.
You haven't come down with a choice.
Yeah, no. I mean, I'd probably go with J.K. Simmons, but no, it's hard. I mean, I sit there and talk myself in and out of that one.
You're cute.
Way too many hours of the day.
I hear you. All right, here we go. We're going for Best Actor. This one is another strange this year. Steve Carell in Foxcatcher, Bradley Cooper in American Sniper, Benedict Cumberbatch. By the way, don't you love that name, Cumberbatch?
Yes, I do.
I think that's a great name.
In The Imitation Game. He's a really good, smart guy.
He's a nice guy. Michael Keaton in Birdman and Eddie Redmayne in The Theory of Everything. But before I ask you, Michael Keaton, Jesus, that guy was just unbelievable in that film. I never was a fan of his, believe this or not.
Well, shame on you.
I know. He made me a fan in that movie. I don't know. There was something about him. I was like, But I loved him in that. But I got to tell you, I yawned through that film. But we'll talk about that film in a minute. But in that category, and I did. I have to, you know, it's an inside film. It's a Hollywood inside film, I think. Steve Carell blew me away. Who knew? And I'm curious about Brad Cooper, because I don't think he's getting enough notice for that, because he really transformed himself, maybe not the way Mr. Cumberbatch did. But talk to me.
Well, one of the things that Steve Carell has, in a sense, going against him, he was exceptional in that role. He could not have been less likable. I mean, that is a guy it's too easy to hate. And that, I mean, that's one of the things that, again, I think context ends up being everything. That's why Eddie Redmayne and Cumberbatch are in there. Those are both, in their own ways, hero types. Bradley Cooper, not so much. But, I mean, you know, I think people have a real ambivalence about that. And then, you know, Michael Keaton, I think, is just, he should get it. Once again, it's a raw, naked performance. It is everything. And it says so much. I mean, you said it as a Hollywood insider kind of film. In a sense, it is. But it's a human film, because we all reach points in life where we realize we can't conquer the world. We only have so much time left. We maybe have peaked. And and it's like one of those things. He's at this point in his life where he's looking at either a new beginning or the end, and that's a scary moment. And all of us humans have that moment. So that's why I love that performance, and that's why I love that film, actually.
You have a lot of heart.
I don't know about that. But I feel passionately, way too passionately.
No. I wish more people felt as much passion as you put forth in your personality than others do. Believe me. Trust me on that. Okay, Best Actress, Marion Cotillard in 2 Days, 1 Night, Felicity Jones in The Theory of Everything, Julianne Moore in Still Alice, Rosamund Pike in Gone Girl, Reese Witherspoon in Wild, and I bet you anything. It's going to go to Julianne Moore, all because she's just made so many roles that are just gorgeous, right? This was amazing.
Yeah.
You agree?
Yeah. I mean, she's a phenomenal actress, and it's ironic because if she gets it for this, I mean, it's long overdue, and she does a really heartrending, wonderful job with Still Alice. It's not a great film.
I agree.
There are a lot of ways that I think the film falls apart, but she's excellent in it. Almost everyone in this category was really good. Marion, Cotillard.
Oh, my gosh.
I can't pronounce anything.
Me either.
So forgive me.
I'm glad that you did
it.
No, you did better than I did.
But she's phenomenal. I mean, she's a phenomenal actress, and it's an incredible role, performance. So she would be my choice. I really like Julianne Moore. I have liked her for years and liked her in so many things, and she is excellent in this film, so I won't feel pointed, but it's this one that I think is as much as anything for a body of work for someone who has been overlooked for way too long. So
right. So in different circumstances, Marion would have won it.
I don't know. I mean, it's like one of those hard films. It's kind of a specific case. So that's like, I love that movie, but it's one that has a very
small audience.
People either love it or don't love it. So
right. Let's get to Best Director real quick. Talk about not being able to say people's names. Birdman, Alejandro Inarritu. Boyhood. Richard
Linklater.
All right. Boyhood. Richard Linklater. Foxcatcher. Bennett Miller. The Grand Budapest Hotel. Wes Anderson. The Imitation Game. Morton Tilden. These guys did a great job this year, all of them, don't you think?
Yeah, I do. I think it's going to come down to Boyhood and Birdman. I mean, you know, actually, all my films that I really love this year start with B's, Budapest, Boyhood, and Birdman. So I think that it will actually, and I don't know, I'm like many people, I think it'll go down to the wire on this one. This is one where every vote counts, and it could be one or two votes that determine this. But I would be surprised if it's not one of those two guys.
So I've always wanted to do this. I've always wanted to say, to be able to say, and the nominees for the Best Picture. Oh, my God, right? Okay, American Sniper, Birdman, Boyhood, The Grand Budapest Hotel, The Imitation Game, Selma, The Theory of Everything, Whiplash. Again, a lot of politics in all of this year, more than any recent year, I think. So, Ms. Betsy Starkey, film critic for the Los Angeles Times, the Best Picture Award for 2015 goes to...
I'm not sure. none of us are sure. I think the dark horse that could surprise is actually American Sniper, in part because the public has embraced it. It has been a film people have liked. They have gone to see. They have embraced it. And with the way international relationships are right now with ISIS, people could vote for that. I honestly think it'll probably, once again, as it will in directors, come down to Birdman and Boyhood. And I kind of think, excuse me for copying, I kind of think Boyhood, because there is something so relatable in that film in terms of family and growing up. And it hits on and touches and reaches into the kind of bits and pieces of Americana that we like about ourselves. It's a very humble film. It's not trying to be big and blow you away. There are no special effects. It is just about people. You can look at that film, you can see yourself, you can see your family, you can see your friends. And I think because of that intimacy and the personal greatness of that film, I really believe it's going to walk away with the Best Picture.
I think that film is testimony to the fact that less is more.
Yes.
Right? We forget that in filmmaking these days. I wish we had more time, but just one last question. You long for the day when you can put on your jammies, microwave your favorite popcorn, and sit back on your comfy couch and just watch for sheer pleasure and not for another reason, a great film.
Yeah, I mean, actually, yes. And there is something about being freed from having to assess it to just enjoy it. It's why I watch, I think, a lot of television. I mean, I'm ridiculous TV addict because I can really just love the lowbrow and be just fine with it.
I've been speaking with Betsy Sharkey, film critic for the Los Angeles Times. Want to interact with Betsy? Her Twitter handle is what else? Betsy Sharkey.
Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org.
And we are back on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, where we are taking a look at the Oscars 2015. Joining me at my table is one of my very favorite people in the whole wide world, Charles Matthau. Now, as many of you know, Charlie's become sort of a fixture on the Hallie Kasser Jane Show, and there's good reason for that. He's making noise in the background. Not only is he one of the funniest people that I know, but he is also one of the kindest people that I know, and I'm always happy to welcome him back. But before I do that officially, a little bit about Charles Matthau. He's a director, a screenwriter, a producer. He's been an actor. He was weaned on film. His father was Academy Award-winning legendary actor Walter Matthau, who exposed young Charlie to every aspect of filmmaking. As a child actor, Charlie appeared alongside his father in a host of films, including Bad News Bears. He turned to directing with his brilliant, and I do say brilliant, direction of the Truman Capote story, The Grass Harp. He moved into film. His latest project is Freaky Deaky, starring Christian Slater, which premiered at the Tribeca Film Festival, and he knows I'm a big fan of that film. He's also graduated from film school at the University of Southern California, and so now that he's had this amazing intro, hi, Charlie.
How are you? Thank you for your kind words.
Kind, aren't you funny, kind. Honest words. I do love you.
I'm glad I told you. Thank you.
Okay, so here we go. You ready?
Yeah.
You ready? All right. This is, this time it's just you and me, by the way. First time.
Okay.
You ready for just you and me?
Sure.
All right, no Andy Dick, no that lemon guy, whatever his name is, no who was on last year on our Oscar show, just you and me. So let's talk Oscar. And I want to begin with a little Oscar trivia. Get this. And all the trivia, by the way, that I'm going to cite on today's show comes from another delightful guy. He's a blogger and he's a movie data and statistician. His name is Stephen Follows. Stephen's done his homework, Charlie. Listen to this. Oscar-nominated films earn an average of $12.7 million more than films that are not nominated. Big business, this Oscar party, but I bet some producers, actors, and director types would rather see the copious amounts of money going into Oscar PR in their pockets. I mean, money's a pretty weird deal in Hollywood these days. To get a film made, which I know you try and do and have done successfully, it's something of a miracle these days, isn't it?
I think that those numbers may change a little bit with the $12.7 million. Reason being that less films are made today, and those films usually are aimed, because they're so expensive to make and so expensive to market, they're aimed at sort of the lowest common denominator, and a lot of them are, you know, tentpole type of films. And so a lot of the films that are nominated are smaller independent movies. And so I have a feeling that at average, where the Oscar-nominated films gross more, that may change over time because the whole dynamic of the industry has changed. But, you know, a film that makes money and a film that's good and gets good reviews and is a work. And every once in a while, you know, they can overlap.
Yeah, not enough, unfortunately, these days. You know, one of this year's Oscars nominees for Best Picture is Richard Linklater's Boyhood. That film took 12 years. Can you imagine? I mean, keeping the actors together, keeping the money together. Whew, what?
Well, it's remarkable. And it's remarkable, first of all, the director is so talented and so visionary. But also, just whoever financed that and took a gamble like that is great. Because, you know, you're not going to get, even if everything goes perfect, you're not going to get your money back for 12 years. So that just took a lot of guts, and it's a wonderful movie.
Yeah, it is a great movie. We're going to talk about it in a minute. Here's a story I wanted to share with you. Years ago, in my Hollywood years, I had some friends, and one of them was the grandson of Arthur Freed, the great producer, songwriter. What didn't Arthur Freed do? Singing in the Rain was his baby, Gigi, and American in Paris, for those who may not know. Anyway, we went over to see his grandma one day, and we walk into this big, ridiculous, gorgeous home of his, in I think it was in Stone Canyon, as a matter of fact, and two back-to-back grand pianos with Oscars. Every award that you, thousands, these pianos were wheezing under the weight of it. And it was a moment in my life that I will never forget. That Oscar thing, it's magic. I mean, just to see the statue is magic. And not many people outside of Hollywood have. You have. Your dad won a bunch of Oscars, if I didn't say it, Walter Matthau. Where are those Oscars? You know, you hear weird stories about Oscars these days. They're being auctioned off. Or they're found in trash pan. Where are your dad's Oscars?
Well, I'm not auctioning off mine. I'm keeping it. And I'm looking at it right now. It's here in the office. And I also have, you know, that guy, he won a lot of awards. I have, you know, multiple Tony Awards and, you know, all kinds of things here.
Do you ever touch the Oscar, just kiss it and go, look at that. One day I'm going to get my own.
Well, you know, from your mouth to God's ears.
You can do it, buddy. I know that you can do it. Listen, I know you went to the Oscars with your dad. You told us that story last Oscar season. But I want to talk to you about something a little bit different with that. And that is, if you can remember as a kid being in the house when your parents, and this is going to bring me to where I really want to go, but if you can remember being in the house with your parents, watching them get ready to go to the Oscars. But I want to talk to you about your mom. Your mother was an amazing lady, and we have never talked on air about your mom, Carol. And I want to do that a little bit now. And I want to give people a little background, just a little bit. I'll let you fill in more of the details. But amongst other things, Truman Capote said that Holly Golightly, my favorite character in every novel that ever has been written, was based on your mom, which tells people a little bit about the kind of character she had. There's rumor.
Based on her personality, not her occupation.
I'm glad you cleared that up. I'm so happy. She also, it's rumored, and you can tell me if this is true or not, because I've heard the story, is rumored to be the daughter of the great Leslie Howard, Ashley in Gone with the Wind. Is that true?
Well, I believe it's true, according to my grandmother, anyway.
She was your mom was in foster care, right? She grew up in that environment and then was lucky enough to be taken in by a very wealthy man who became her dad. She had some interesting marriages, an interesting marriage, at least beside your dad, although that marriage was pretty terrific because look what it produced. Talk to me about your mom.
Well, she hated going to the Oscars, and she said that, you know, before she went and she would watch it, you know, on television or whatever it was, seemed one way. But then when she actually went and when her husband was nominated, it had a whole other feel to it. It was, you know, 80% of the nominees lose and there's sort of a competition to it. And my father never really took it seriously. He always thought that it was a popularity contest and that the only way to, you know, to have a real competition for acting would be if all five actors played the same role. And even then, you know, competition between actors would be silly. So, you know, that was their view of it. But, you know, my father knew that it was part of the business, and he knew that a lot of people watched the show. I mean, he actually hosted the show three times.
Yeah.
And was nominated several times, and of course, won for the Fortune Cookie. But he never took those shows very seriously.
I digressed. I want to get back to you. Let's go to you, and you've been very successful. You know, not anybody can get a film made, and you did in a big budget film and with some pretty gosh darn people besides the other films that you did, but I'm referring, of course, to the Freaky Deaky film that I think is one of the most hilarious things ever. So I want to ask you a question, okay? Yeah, your dad was Walter Matthau and your mom was Carol, but tell me the truth. Who did you sleep to get to the top? Who was it?
Well, I didn't sleep with my parents.
I mean, everybody always thinks it's an easy ride for somebody who's got a father, you know, or a mother who's like the star. You know, I have a lot of friends in Hollywood. You know, I grew up with a lot of my friends, you know, who were directors and actors, fathers and mothers who were actresses and, you know, that kind of thing. I think life is hell for you guys personally. And you're like the only one I know that really came out, you know, fairly intact from it. It's a blessing and it's not a blessing, right?
It's a blessing and it's not a blessing. I mean, but it's a mixed bag. Like, for example, Kirk Douglas, one of his sons, is incredibly successful. But, you know, when I go and I visit my parents at their grave, two graves over on the left is Eric Douglas, who was Kirk's son, and he died tragically at a very young age and had a lot of issues. So it's a, you know, it's a mixed bag. It's certainly not the golden ticket to do whatever you want, but it certainly gives you some advantages, too. And a lot depends, too, on who the people are, because I was lucky that my parents had me when they were a little bit older, and so they were more relaxed, they had more wisdom to impart, and they weren't sort of struggling to find out who they were.
Yeah, you know, and I'm going to tell you another story, which is kind of funny. From outside, you know, I've gotten to know you so well over the years, and you know how much I love you. I know who you are. I remember in the beginning when I first had you on thinking, how's he going to feel about talking about his dad? You know, like people want you to talk about you. Father, not necessarily you. I have you on the show because I think you're such a character in your own right. But you know what I'm saying? You can understand where people...
Yeah, no, I understand, but I don't blame people because he was such an amazing, fascinating, one in a billion kind of guy.
Yeah, well, it takes a man to be able to say that too. Charlie, digital film indies, we were talking, we referred to it kind of like a passing, but big changes going on in the movie business, as you just said. You know what I just read today? That Modern Family is about to air a show that was shot entirely on iPhones, iPads, and MacBook Pros. Is that bizarre?
Wow.
Isn't that amazing?
Great. I didn't know that. That's
yeah.
Awesome.
But that's a double-edged sword, too, because anybody can make a film now. Some might have talent. It's kind of like what's happening in all of the arts right now. Radio, like where I am, is also going through that, where anybody can do, quote-unquote, a podcast, and 95% of it isn't worth listening to, and the 10% that it is, how do you get it out there for people to listen to? It's the same thing with film, right?
Yeah, I mean, probably with any art form, but, you know, with film, of course, you know, has historically taken millions of dollars, whereas a writer can just go and write, or a painter can just go and paint, and so I think it's great. I'm totally for it, because somebody who has a vision, and particularly, you know, if it's a person telling the story, a lot of times, even if they have no budget, that's going to be more interesting than something that's made by a marketing committee. And, you know, and then when a lot of money is spent, everybody tends to get conservative and shoot for the lowest common denominator and sort of dumb down things and be afraid to take risks and be afraid to have a voice. And so I'm totally in favor of it. I think that's great.
Here's more Oscar trivia from He Who Knows Everything About the Film Business and more Stephen Follows from StephenFollows.com. Listen to this one. Best actor winners can expect a $3.9 million salary increase, right? It's only $500,000 for women. That ticks me off. Here's another. Stephen tells me a full-page ad in The Hollywood Reporter in Oscar season cost $72,000. You know, my good friend Diane Ladd took an ad out in The Hollywood Reporter for her daughter Laura Dern. Tell everybody, of course, to vote for Laura, who's up for Best Supporting Actress for her role in Wild. You going to vote for Laura because her mom took an ad out? What do you think about that?
Well, I'm surprised that it costs that much, because very few people even read the trade papers anymore. Now they get their information from the internet.
They read it enough that the story made it into page 6 in New York, like, va-va-voom story. Oh, my God, the world was up in arms about it. Crazy. Say, go, you go, girl. Why not? It's your daughter. You're an industry insider. You can afford it. Why wouldn't you push the hell out of it? I mean, you know, Bruce Dern's daughter or whatever. But that brings us to, you didn't answer my question, but we're about to find out, because I'm going to say, here's who's up for Best Supporting Actress. Okay? Patricia Arquette for Boyhood, Emma Stone for Birdman, Meryl Streep Into the Woods, Keira Knightley The Imitation Game, and Laura Dern Wild. You tell me who you'd pick, and I'll tell you who I'd pick.
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, all five were amazing, including Laura Dern. I would say the winner is going to be Patricia Arquette for Boyhood. I would probably vote for Keira Knightley, because I just love that
Don't preview.
And so, yeah, all five of them were out.
That they were. I would probably vote for Laura, but that's only because I love Diane so much. I would because of a body of work. And Patricia Arquette was good too. It would be between those two, I think. I love Keira Knightley, but I think there are other roles she's been in that have just been so spectacular. Pride and Prejudice.
Oh, yeah, no, she has no chance.
Right.
She's not going to win.
Right.
Who else is there besides those three?
Emma Stone and Birdman, which I didn't get. It was cute. And she hasn't earned it. And Meryl Streep, Into the Woods. You'll have to listen because, you know, what? I pre-recorded my interview with Becky Sharkey before this one. And you'll have to hear what she has to say when the show airs. But she's got an interesting take on all of on Meryl Streep.
The winner is going to be Patricia Arquette.
I agree.
And if for some reason I'm wrong, then it'll be Emma Stone. But unlikely, it'll probably be Patricia Arquette.
I am with you on that 100%.
It'll be one of those two.
Right.
Bank on it.
And Arquette, you know, that's another family. That's another, you know, Hollywood family. All right, Hollywood scandal. Here's what I was reading this afternoon on the Drudge Report headlines. Oscars shock claim votes are actually cast by Hollywood housemaids. Oy vey. I don't think they needed that a couple of days before the Oscar airs. Isn't that amazing? But there it is. It was all over the news today. Here's more Oscar trivia, by the way, from Stephen. Oscar voters are 94% white, 77% male, and have a median age of 62.
Interesting. I know my father always gave me his Oscar ballot because he just didn't care.
You're kidding. To vote?
Yeah. And also, I saw more movies than he did, too, and he knew I loved movies and
really?
And into it and had opinions and stuff like that. And he just thought the whole thing was silly, and he just really couldn't care less.
Isn't that fascinating? Well, there's something people could write about tomorrow or the next day or the day after the Oscars. Okay, with all that in mind, look at the nominees.
Yeah, what are they going to do? Throw them out of the Academy?
Yeah, I'm just saying. You made the case. So here are the Oscar nominees for, I could do this like I'm on the stage. And the Oscar nominees for the Best Supporting Actor are, or I should say Best Supporting Actor in a Supporting Role are Robert Duvall, who in for The Judge, who I, by the way, cannot see as a supporting actor. He's, oh man, he's on top for me. Mark Ruffalo in Foxcatcher, Ethan Hawke, Boyhood, Edward Norton, Birdman, J.K. Simmons, Whiplash. I want to say something about J.K. Simmons, who I had never seen before or that it registered, and now he's in every damn movie that I'm watching lately. I'm going, where'd you come from, buddy? Okay, what's your choice?
J.K. Simmons is definitely going to win.
Wow.
He's such a good actor. I just Farmers Insurance commercial. But that's why my father said that he would never do a commercial, and he never did, because one time he was at an off-Broadway play of production of King Lear, and the actor on stage was riveting and giving this amazing performance, and the couple that was sitting in front of my dad kept whispering to each other, trying to figure out where they knew him from, and finally the wife says to the husband, I got it. He's the Tidy Bowl Man.
You are kidding. That's hilarious. Seriously. That's a great story.
True story.
He had that kind of face, though, your dad, you know? He could do anything, yep, and be anywhere at any time and just kind of morph into it. That was what made him such a genius. All right, factoid. I know my audience wants to hear what I have to say about this, so I'm going to say, I bet you it's Edward Norton. But I think Ethan Hawke is long overdue for recognition because he's great in everything he does. But I think
he's highly annoying because he's great at everything. He's a great actor. He's a great writer.
Yeah, really.
He's way too good looking. And,
yeah, he's
that's
unique.
That's all I have to say about that guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Factoid, it costs around $3,500 to prepare a Hollywood actress for the red carpet. I find that extraordinary. You know why? Because there's no way you could do it. Me, I would be spending $10,000 just on the dress. But okay, well, that's me. Best actress in a leading role. Here are your nominees. Felicity Jones, The Theory of Everything. Marion Cotillard, 2 Days, 1 Night. Rosamund Pike, Gone Girl. Reese Witherspoon, Wild. Julianne Moore, Still Alice. I think this is an easy one, but tell me who you think.
Julianne Moore is the winner.
Yep.
Bank on it. 100. I think Rosalind Pike should win because she looks a lot like my mother.
You're such a pistol. You really are.
I didn't get the Felicity Jones nomination. I just didn't get that one at all. Reese Witherspoon, I love in everything that she does. But she's not in right now in Hollywood after her little escapade with the drinking. But I'm with you, 100% Julianne Moore. Rosamund Pike, again, interesting. She's starting to build herself a nice body of work. She's got a strong future. The nominees for Best Actor in a Leading Role are Steve Carell, Foxcatcher, Bradley Cooper, American Sniper, Benedict Cumberbatch, The Imitation Game, Eddie Redmayne, The Theory of Everything, Michael Keaton, Birdman.
This is the first race that you've brought up that is maybe too close to call. I think it'll be that brilliant actor that was in The Theory of Everything. I think he's going to win.
Redmayne.
If he doesn't, it'll be Michael Keaton. Although, there's a slight chance, and it's probably a long shot, but he could be the sleeper, would be Bradley Cooper.
Okay. I'm with you that this is the tight race. I think Keaton's going to get it because Hollywood loves Michael Keaton. That's what I think it's going to be.
I have a feeling that he may be right.
Right. But I'm going to tell you that the performance that I thought, the Steve Carell, that movie was very upsetting to me. The whole thing, Steve Carell being so creepy, and my favorite Mark Ruffalo, who I think should never play anything but a man who takes his clothes off and shows us his hairy chest, and he's just the most divine thing ever walking. I don't want to see him in character roles. I don't want him to do that. So that kind of annoyed me in that role. I thought Bradley Cooper, though, he just bowled that movie, but that's another story. We'll get to that. He just bowled me over in that film, and the politics got in the way of a lot. But when you think about who he is and what he pulled off, wow, that's my take on that. Now, Charlie, you've been directing in films and TV for a long time, so I'm curious to hear what your pick is as best director. I'm really curious about this. So let me give you the names. Alejandro Iñárritu for Birdman, Richard Linklater for Boyhood, Bennett Miller, Foxcatcher, Wes Anderson, The Grand Budapest Hotel, and Morton Tilden, The Imitation Game. And the winner is?
Well, if it was up to me, it would be The Imitation Game, but it has no chance. The winner will either be Birdman or Boyhood, probably Birdman.
Okay, we're going to see about that one. This is interesting to me. On these films this year, you and I talked off air about this the other day, but I wanted to talk about it on air, and that is one of the things that bothered me. I think three of the films did this, and that is instead of ending, they told the story in words at the end of the films. That made me nuts. Did you go back and look at that? Were you aware of that?
Well, I remember it in American Sniper, because I thought I really wanted to find out what happened. I won't spoil it for anybody who hasn't seen the movie, but I really wanted to find out why what happened. And I was disappointed that wasn't part of the movie. But what were the other two?
Theory of Everything and The Imitation Game.
Imitation Game, I think, pretty much told the story. I thought that was just such a brilliant film.
I know you how much you love that. I guess what it is, and we're not talking about best, adapted screenplay or writer or any of that kind of stuff today, but I guess that's what bothered me. It's like, to my mind, that's like a 1940s, well, that's easy to finish it that way. I don't know, man, that's just the way I think, but I may be wrong.
Well, I think it depends on what is covered by that, because in The Imitation Game, the most interesting part to me was him inventing the computer and winning world, breaking the Nazi Enigma code. The later stuff was interesting, but it wasn't as interesting as the World War II stuff. So, I understood its use there. In American Sniper, I do wish that had been dramatized so we could know more about that.
Right. I love that film, though. I did. Okay. Who won the best film last year? Best actor, best actress. Can you remember?
Last year? Jeez, I don't even remember what I had for breakfast.
I had to ask that question because, you know what? I can't answer. I mean, I went to look it up, and I'm not going to tell you. I'm not going to tell the audience. You guys are going to have to go look it up. But I wonder how many people really remember. We make such a thing about these Oscars, and then you can't even remember the film that won for the best actress. Best film, best actor, best actress. Kind of an interesting thing. Okay, a little bit more trivia. Stephen Fella follows. 56% of Best Picture nominees were released in either November or December, and the cost of a Best Picture winning Oscar campaign is around, listen to this figure, $10 million. A Best Picture can win is worth $3 million in increased box office gross? I thought it would be more than that. So here we go. Best Picture. Did you let the cat out of the bag? Up for
only $3 million?
Only three. I thought that was like ridiculous, but that's what he said. We got to go find that out to see whether.
Yeah,
that's...
I'm not sure. I think it depends too on what the movie is. You know, for example, if The Imitation Game won, or Whiplash won, or, you know, one of those long shot movies mm-hmm. won for Best Picture, it would make a lot more than $3 million because, a lot, you know, so yeah, few
yeah, people want to see it, right?
On the other hand, if American Sniper wins, it's not going to make that much of a difference because everybody's seen that movie.
Exactly. Yeah. It's curious. I'm going to ask him about that. So the nominees for Best Picture are Selma, Birdman, The Imitation Game, Whiplash, Boyhood, The Theory of Everything, American Sniper, The Grand Budapest Hotel. And the winner is?
The winner is Birdman. If it doesn't win, it's going to be Boyhood. It's possible that a long shot could sneak in because of the way that they do the voting, where people rank their five favorite films. And they take the 10 and they rank them, and so it allows for vote splitting. And every once in a while, film that has very passionate supporters can sneak through if other films are splitting the vote. So it wouldn't be the shock of the century if an American Sniper won, but it would be a surprise for sure. I'm pretty confident it's either going to be Birdman or Boyhood. And my money's on Birdman as the winner. Of course, if it was up to me, I would pick The Imitation Game.
Right. And so here's what's interesting. I'm with you on that in terms of Birdman and Boyhood, and I think it's between the two of them. And I think Birdman might pull it off because it's an inside Hollywood film.
And most of the Academy members are actors.
Right, right. And they get the film. Exactly. Because I personally, the film didn't do it for me. On it. I mean, I even fell asleep in the middle of it, and I don't ever do that. How do you like that? It just, like, I like yawn. On the other hand, I thought that Boyhood was just enchanting. Yeah, that's the right word for that film. We will see, right? I want to go into one other thing before we close, and that's a beef that I have. And it's one I think you can appreciate, and I'm curious to hear what you have to say about it. I want to talk to you about what happened to the adult movie. And I don't mean 50 Shades of Grey, adult movie. Yeah, let's leave that out of this conversation. I'm talking about films like The Odd Couple or The Apartment or Something's Gotta Give or The Way We Were or Charade or, for goodness sakes, Breakfast at Tiffany's, right? Character-driven films I'm talking about. Films with great plots, love stories, films that matter. Because if I see one more film, Charlie, of one guy beating up another guy because somebody ticked him off, right? And guns, rat-a-tat-tat-tat. And bad Russian accents, which is like in vogue again. You know, it's like the Cold War is back. I mean, what's going on? No writers? What is it?
Well, it's less films are being made because they're so expensive to make. And so there's five or six studios that control all the distribution. And so less films are being made. It costs a fortune to market. And so people studio heads are concerned for their job, and they want to make safe choices. So they'll take a comic book that already has a following of 20 million people, as opposed to taking a chance on something that may not appeal to, you know, teenagers who buy most of the movie tickets.
I always thought that was kind of a weird deal, too, because, I don't know, I think adults would buy more tickets. And adults have a lot more money today than kids do. If they would appeal to adults, and you know, you said something in the beginning of this conversation about playing to the lowest common denominator. I don't know, I think Hollywood needs to take the bull by the horns and change that. And maybe you'll do that in your next project. What's happening in Charlie's career?
Well, I'm doing, you know, I've done 7 movies, and every time you have to reinvent the wheel. So I am trying to get a little more into television. I have a book by Liza Monroy called Mexican High that we're working on doing a series. I've been asked to direct a film called 7 Deadly Sins, which is a very funny youth-oriented comedy. And, you know, a bunch of stuff. But we'll see it. You know, it's like a miracle to get a movie made. So we just keep plugging along.
And with that, what can we say? But hooray for Hollywood. What? Help me end this.
I don't see how you can end it any better than that.
I've been speaking with director, writer, producer, Charles Matthau. For more information about Charles Matthau, visit The Matthau Company at matthau.com. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at Hallie Kasser-Jane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.